You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is the 22nd of July, and it is 11:02 in the morning. And first up, we are going to have a news item from Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is called Maroon Prevails, and it's from prisonradio.org.
Maroon Prevails. Russell Maroon Schultz, after many years of hard struggle, has prevailed on his action to bar the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections from ever holding him in isolation again. In a remarkable settlement bringing an end to Schultz v. Wetzel, Maroon won on all counts. The only thing lacking is a judge's written opinion. Upon learning of the settlement, Maroon stated, "I have nothing but praise for all of those who supported me and my family for all the years I was in solitary confinement, as well as helped to effect my release. Since joining the struggle for human rights in the mid-1960s, I have always chosen to fight. Frederick Douglass was right when he said, power concedes nothing without a demand. So have no doubt that I see this settlement as anything but the latest blow struck, and you rest assured that I will continue in the struggle for human rights. Straight ahead, Russell Maroon Schultz." Under the terms of the settlement, the DOC has agreed to not place Maroon in solitary over his prior disciplinary record. He is to be single-celled for life, and Maroon was granted a monetary settlement. Maroon was held in solitary confinement from 1983 to 2014, with the exception of 19 months he spent in federal custody at Leavenworth, where he lived in general population. So for 22 consecutive years, a lifetime, Russell Maroon Schultz has been held by the state of Pennsylvania in isolation, conditions described as torture by the United Nations Special Rapporteur Juan Mendez, who called for Maroon's release from solitary. Mendez served as a defense expert for Schultz. Russell Maroon Schultz was represented in this federal civil rights action by Brett Grove and Dustin McDaniel, Esquires of the Abolitionist Law Center of Pittsburgh, Harold J. Engel, Esquire, and attorneys Rick Etter and Stephanie L. Burt of the law firm Reed Smith. The struggle continues, and sometimes you win. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia, and I'm going to be your host for today's show. First up, we have a bunch of news items for you. Prisoners in Wisconsin are still on hunger strike. According to an article by the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism published on July 14th at channel3000.com, a judge in Wisconsin recently refused a request by prisoner Cesar DeLeon that officials at Waupun Correctional Institution stop force-feeding him. DeLeon had been on hunger strike for about a month before officials at the prison began force-feeding him. The article noted that DeLeon is one of at least eight prisoners at two institutions in Wisconsin who have been on hunger strike since early June protesting the use of long-term solitary confinement. Prisoners in Ely State Prison in Nevada have been on hunger strike since July 12th. They are protesting policies and conditions of the disciplinary segregation units. At least six prisoners are on hunger strike. They have five demands, including the installation of additional phones, the provision of 2,500 calories on each day with adequate food portions, the ability to buy appliances every 60 days, the ability to go to the barber two times a week, and the ability to purchase clothes, hygiene, and food items from the commissary. Supporters are being asked to call the Ely State Prison Warden's office at 777-289-8800 extension 3 and ask to speak to Warden Renee Baker at extension 1. There are other phone numbers to call and a sample phone script available online at itsgoingdown.org. Palestinian prisoner Bilal Kayed has recently been shackled to a hospital bed on his 34th day of a hunger strike. According to Samidun.net, over 45 Palestinian prisoners are now on an open hunger strike against administrative detention and in solidarity with Bilal Qayed. Qayed was supposed to be released after the completion of his 14-and-a-half-year sentence on June 13th, when instead he was ordered to 6 months administrative detention without charge or trial. He has been on hunger strike since the 15th of June. For more information, you can visit Samidun.net. This next news piece comes from the website RafifiBloomington.wordpress.com in Bloomington, Indiana. We share it in the lead-up to Prisoners' Justice Day, which is commemorated every year on August 10th. Clinton Boo Gilkey was held in the Monroe County Jail in Indiana since he was 16 after a failed robbery using a toy gun. He was set to be released from jail in late June. After sitting for 22 months, he was finally being offered a plea deal for time served. He qualified for bail, just $1,000, the entire time he was imprisoned, but was too poor to get out. On June 7, 2016, less than 2 weeks before his release date, Boo died inside the Monroe County Jail. His incarceration was absurd, his death murder. Even though Boo's death was quieter than that of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge or Philando Castile outside St. Paul, who were both cut down by the cops, it follows the same pattern. The premature death coldly dealt out to those who are poor and or black in this society, whether by bullet, coercion, or neglect. Because Boo's family was poor, he was considered indigent, which means the state would be forced to pay for his medication as long as he had no money on his books. When his family was able to put $10 a month on, it was immediately taken by the jail to cover the cost of his medication. The only way Boo had enough money on his commissary to pay for necessary food that met his dietary restrictions and calorie needs was to refuse his medication. This means he was given the choice between access to food or access to medication. The immediate cause of Boo's death was an aortic aneurysm, the result of the jail's failure to treat a pre-existing heart condition called Marfan syndrome, a genetic disorder. The jail was aware of Boo's diagnosis and family medical history. Medicine and routine tests can manage the condition, but the jail denied Boo access to these basic resources. When he died, the guards tried to claim it was an overdose and immediately isolated all of his blockmates, interrogating them and ransacking their dorm. Ex-prisoners who were released shortly after his death and other recent deaths reported that they were blamed, mistreated, and had no substantial support for trauma and loss. Counseling for survivors wasn't made available, even at their request. While jail staff targeted and attempted to incriminate Boo's blockmates, we know who the real killers are. The jail medical staff, the jail administration, and an institution that criminalizes race and poverty. Boo's premature death comes close on the heels of two suicides and countless suicide attempts in the jail over the last year and a half. These deaths have been under a new administration and jail-appointed medical provider. A suicide had not taken place in the jail for more than 30 years before this. A rise in jail overcrowding, minors tried and held as adults, incarceration for illness and poverty, and an increasing disregard for human life also mark an escalation beyond the last three already miserable decades of incarceration. The system assumes it can keep failing our communities. This assumption relies on our hopelessness and complacency. The people in charge know that many of us get angry when teenagers are left to rot and die inside wretched cells, but they think we'll stay quiet or take it out on each other. The rebels in Ferguson have demonstrated, though, that the only practical response is to find each other, combine our rage, and fight back against the enemy that cages or kills our friends, family, and loved ones. The legal system offers no protection to the poor, let alone to black teenagers. Our only protection, our best weapon, is solidarity. What limits their violence and neglect is fear of our collective power. If you miss Boo or are angry about his loss, you can spread the word about his death, fight against the media's effort to sanitize the murder. They are simply acting as the mouthpiece of the jail and the cops. Revolt against his murder, against the next murder by law enforcement, and against the daily oppression across the society that mirrors and exceeds that of the prison. Remember that the Ferguson cop who murdered Michael Brown would not have faced any repercussions at all if a rebellion hadn't broken out. Organize now in our communities to solve problems for ourselves and be prepared to address harm instead of calling cops. If you've ever considered testifying against someone, remember that you might not just be sending them to jail, but to their death. Stop snitching. And that was from RafifiBloomington.wordpress.com. And next we are going to have a song.
That was the song Laura by the band Prison from Copenhagen. The time is presently 11:16, and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. Coming up on Sunday, August 7th, there will be a Prisoner's Justice Day punk show. The show will be at Brasserie Beaubien at 73 Beaubien East. Doors are 8 p.m., music and presentations start at 8:30 p.m. The show will feature the bands Prison from Copenhagen and Terse and Claiborne, which are both local bands. The show will also feature presentations from the Termite Collective about Prisoners' Justice Day and books from local publisher Chris Blebedev. Come early, stay late. The event is $5 to $10 sliding scale, and no one turned away for lack of funds. You can find out more information about the show at kersplebedev.com, and that's KERSPLEBEDEB.com.
Up next, we have members of the Prisoner Correspondence Project in the studio with us. Three members of the project's organizing collective recently went down to New York to visit Sarah, who writes the advice column for the project's newsletter. According to the Correspondence Project's Facebook page, Sarah is also working on a lawsuit to establish programming for trans prisoners in New York State. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks so much for having us.
Do you two want to introduce yourselves and talk a bit about what the Prisoner Correspondence Project is? I know you've been on the show before, but just refresh all of our memories.
Hi, my name's Olivia.
I'm Josh.
And the Prisoner Correspondence Project is a working group of Keyburg Miguel and Keyburg Concordia. And it's a support project for LGBTQ prisoners across Canada and the U.S. So we currently have approximately 1,700 members, inside members, across the two countries.
We operate principally as a pen pal project, but we also send in scenes, resources, and do advocacy on behalf of people who write to us.
Cool. So three people from the project recently visited Sarah, who's an advice columnist for your newsletter. Do you want to tell us more about Sarah and talk more about the trip?
Yeah, so the newsletter is called The Word Is Out and goes out twice a year to all of the members. And for the past couple of years, at least, Sarah has started up a advice column called Crush and Blush.
And uses the name Widow. Since writing for the newsletter, she's become incredibly popular. previous to that, we had tried to write our own advice column, and it was really just done with the intention of getting someone from the inside to do it, which happened very quickly and obviously has surpassed our expectations and whatever we had previous to that. So it's been really incredible, and we've been getting more and more letters for her, which we pass on to her, and she's been sending back some really incredible responses.
So she's a trans woman incarcerated in a men's prison and has been in prison for the past 5 years in New York State.
We've also been in touch with her personally outside of the newsletter, getting updates on this case that she's building to get access to sex reassignment surgeries and just generally increase improve conditions for trans women in prison. There have been some updates that, I mean, it's still in progress, but according to her, there might be a pilot program that would start as soon as next year, though that's still being negotiated.
And she's in a prison that's run by New York State or in a federal prison in New York State?
Run by New York State.
Okay, so the kinds of things that she's pushing for might apply to prisoners in New York State prisons across the state.
Exactly.
Okay, cool, cool. How is it seeing folks that you usually correspond with by letter face-to-face? You guys want to talk a little bit about like what the process of visiting her was like?
Yeah, it was amazing because our membership is so spread out. We've got members from Alaska to Arizona to Florida. And so because of that, we don't get to visit people as much as we often would like. And so this was a pretty amazing experience.
Definitely. I think we were all a little bit nervous about going just because we'd been writing to her for quite a while now, and we're really excited about it. And I think leading up to it, it was even more nerve-wracking because I had planned sort of, I'd made all these calls, and then 2 weeks before visiting her, she was unexpectedly transferred. So all of the plans we had made just had to change all of a sudden, which happens more often than, you know, we would think. So it was a surprise visit, too. We had originally planned to visit her in one facility, and she knew about it, but she didn't know that we knew about her change of address. So we kind of just showed up out of the blue at a maximum security prison, hoping that she would agree to see us, which was a bit of a, I guess, a bit of a gamble. But since we built this relationship with her, I guess it wasn't completely out of the blue. But it was definitely a little nerve-wracking leading up to it. But it was really amazing to see her. We didn't have too much trouble getting in, apart from maybe our outfits that were a little too scandalous, meaning leggings and a skirt, just completely unacceptable. But we got to spend like over 2 hours with her. We got to have a really nice long talk. And I think I... More than I imagined, we were able to really, you know, we were able to like hug and take pictures together and really kind of get into it. And even though we were a little nervous about meeting each other for the first time, it was surprisingly like comfortable and easy to talk.
Mm-hmm. For me, it was the first time that I'd visited someone in an American prison. And so some of the differences between that and the Canadian prisons were very, very fascinating. For example, in the Canadian prisons, as I'm sure you know, you have to put in your name to get all kinds of background checks and get approvals before there's any possibility of you being able to have a visit. But for this, you just have to show up on the day with a valid piece of ID, and you're allowed in.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned on Facebook that Sarah's been transferred something like 5 times or 6 times in the last 5 years.
6 times in 5 years.
Okay. Yeah. What's it been like trying to stay in touch with her every time she gets transferred? How did you guys find out that she had gotten transferred this time around?
Well, this time around it was just lucky. Like, I called to check final details about coming to visit, about hours, and then they said, oh, she's not here anymore. And so that was really just like, I was like, oh, okay, where is she now? Because we're coming like tomorrow. So I think that was just a stroke of luck. But for the most part, because she is in such regular contact with us, and most people in the project, especially those who like receiving our newsletter, will give us an updated address almost immediately. Or, you know, we do a little bit of sleuthing too. Whenever mail comes back to us, we can usually find out pretty quickly. Again, a totally very weird thing with the American prison system is that you can find out whether people have been moved or not, which is a little more difficult to find out in Canada. Mm-hmm.
Can you guys talk about, you're talking about it already, but can you talk a little bit more about some of the challenges of having a project that functions across prison walls? And what are some of the ways that the Prisoner Correspondence Project moves through these challenges?
So for us, the primary means of communication that we use is letters, right? Which opens up a whole host of potential problems in terms of, as Olivia was talking about, knowing where people are is a big one. But then also, even when you know where someone is, just getting the letter through the mailroom to them and through the censorship, they can be turned back for any number of ridiculous things, like having staples in something.
Tape. It's so arbitrary sometimes. And I think that's the problem, is that you're trying to map out how to send things, and so that you can try to make it as easy as possible for yourself, for the person you're sending mail to, and for the prison itself. But the fact, it doesn't help that because we are sending things all over the US and Canada, each prison has its own set of rules. In Canada, it's actually gotten worse, I believe, in that they will send back photocopies of things sometimes. So it's just like, it's just an uphill battle, like sending the mail at all.
One of the main problems that we face, given the mandate of the project, is that often depictions of homosexuality are one of the things that's deemed contraband. It's put on the same level in some states as bestiality, and just open pornography.
Mm-hmm. And the boards of many prisons, especially in the south of the U.S., are... evangelical, so you know that when the prison administration is set against the project. It makes sending anything. And I mean, you know, people know, like, even though our project, the name is, we tried to make the name kind of neutral.
So it's not the people who are receiving mail.
Yeah.
After a certain point.
Yeah. Josh was saying that, that his pen pal was like, yeah, you're not fooling anyone. Everyone knows when it comes in what it is. So I don't think we're really getting away with it. But again, like, totally arbitrary. We recently got on the list of approved Texas vendors. So, you know, I think it really is just this trial and error. You have to keep trying to send things in different ways. We have a specific Florida form letter that we send that has a different wording. You can't use the word pen pal. And sometimes it gets in, sometimes it doesn't, but it did increase the amount of mail that we got in Florida. But again, it's like hard to know if you're doing the right thing, which is definitely one of the challenges that, you know.
Another issue that you come up with a lot is the discrepancy between what a policy is and how it actually gets enacted. So a really good example of that is when we were doing the visit this past weekend, we went and like checked what all of the clothing requirements were before we go in. And one of them said that your shorts had to be at least mid thigh. So we made sure that all of our shorts were mid thigh before going. There's a picture on our Facebook page where you can see exactly what people were wearing. And we got there and got turned away for too much skin. With the argument that, well, those might be mid-thigh right now, but when you sit down, they could ride up.
Someone was having a bad day, you know? So we went into town and bought some track pants and went right back in. So, but it's not always that simple to bypass these rules. And I know that a lot of people on the inside face a lot of, it's just like a lot of frustration, especially with their pen pals too. Their pen pals aren't always aware of this. So, it can create huge delays in receiving mail, or just like some people we haven't been able to get through for months at a time. So there's a lot of obstacles when it comes to that. I think there's a lot of obstacles in other, I mean, I'd say generally that's one, but like also being a prison abolition group, I think we face other obstacles just as like functioning as a collective and as a project as well, in terms of being received by the public. Mm-hmm.
I know you guys brought some of Sarah's stuff to read. I was wondering if you want to do that now, and then maybe we can wrap up with some of these questions about like how people can get in touch with you and things like that.
For sure.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right, so I'm going to read out the question, and then Olivia's going to read out the answer. So this is a letter from Charlie that says, "Dear Widow, I've got a question. How can you deal with a long-distance relationship with your spouse not writing back, especially when they know you love them due to your writing them with lots of love?"
Dear Cheer Up Charlie, long-distance relationships are unforgiving and hell on the heart, and that's even when both parties are committed to making it work. It breaks my heart to hear the desperation in this question, but I have to be honest. And she always is. It's probably time to move on. Distance relationships depend upon three simple tiers: love, trust, and respect. If even one of these is missing on either side, it's going to crumble under your feet. The problem here, Charlie, is that your spouse doesn't respect you enough to write back and show you the same love you show them. I know it isn't easy to move on. Trust me, I've been in your shoes. But you need to love and respect yourself enough to know when enough is enough. You're chasing ghosts of your past, and until you find a way to let go, you won't be able to know how sweet real love can be from someone new. Put yourself first, Widow. Some sound advice for all of us.
We have a couple minutes left for this interview, so I'm wondering if you guys have any upcoming events happening that you want to tell people in Montreal about?
Yeah, so coming up on August 5th, we have an event that's going to be our first time running it. We're going to be doing a flash collective. So the idea of the flash collective came about through Avram Finkelstein, who's one of the artists involved in the Silence Equals Death collective, that came up with the iconic ACT UP poster. So the idea is that you gather a bunch of artists and activists together for a day and thoroughly discuss an issue and then break out into groups and develop different kinds of popular education or propaganda pieces along the topic, and so that everything's completed by the end of the day and by the end of the session. So again, that's going to be August 5th. We're still working out some of the details, but if you check out our Facebook page, everything will be there once it's sorted out.
Yeah, and another vague event to throw out. She'll most likely be happening on August 6th. Will be a flash tattoo fundraiser. We did one last year, and it was really, really amazing. So we have actually three or four artists that have signed on, and they're all incredible. I won't release their names yet because it's not confirmed, nor is the location. But, you know, again, it'll be on the Facebook page. It's going to be great. So we'll let you know what's going on with that.
We also have weekly volunteer days if people are interested in getting involved in the project. So you can come Tuesdays or Thursdays from 3 till 8 at Cooper Concordia, 1500 de Maisonneuve West, number 204.
Cool. So you answered half of my next question, which is how can people from both the inside and the outside get involved? I know a lot of folks listen to the Prison Radio Show in prisons around Montreal. So if you want to give people like a way for them to get in touch with you all, if they want to get involved in the project. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can write, if you're writing from the inside, you can write to Prisoner Correspondence Project, care of Cooper Concordia, 1455 de Maisonneuve West, H3G1M8. Montreal, Quebec.
And if you have access to email, you can email us at info@prisonercorrespondenceproject.com.
Great. Is there anything I missed? Anything you want to add? You guys want to read great. One more advice thing before we go? I think we have like a few more minutes.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of naughtier ones that I was kind of not sure if we should go to.
It's fine.
The first one, yeah, it's fine.
Dear Widow, where's the love for the mature man who's attracted to trans women?
Dear Divine, you truly are a divine creature, an amazingly aged fine wine, and never let any woman, trans or not, tell you otherwise. My many kudos for you for knowing what you want and seeking it out. As a trans woman, I know this issue very well. I myself typically am attracted more to mature men than the youngish younger men. This is because, for me, I'm looking at 26 years old. For a man who is ready for a committed relationship to settle down and to be 100% drama game free. My husband is 43. FYI, they broke up and she is single and back on the market. And is an amazing man who diligently takes care of me in every way. The problem is that most trans women in prison are relatively young and are still actively in the game. They're like a kid in a candy shop and want the best of every kind of candy available. Many see mature men as being a stale candy bar. What you need to remember is that it's what you want. If it's what you want, you have to go after it rather than waiting for it to come to you. Also, it's all in how you carry yourself, my dear divine. Confidence and drama-free actions will win you an admirer. So don't be frustrated or lonely, and get out on the field and find your piece of candy. Love, Widow.
Great. Thank you so much for coming on the show, guys. It's always great to hear from the Prisoner Correspondence Project.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
CKUT is hiring a news coordinator. You think you got the chops to come run the news department at Montreal's number one community radio station? Come work with us. The CKUT news coordinator is responsible for training volunteers, researching news stories, organizing special events and coverage, and overseeing all news programming at CKUT. If you have experience in community journalism or radio, have your finger on the pulse of activism in Montreal, and love working with volunteers, then you belong here. All candidates must be approved for the Subvention Salariale program at Emploi Québec. Call your local Centre Local d'Emploi for more info. To find the full details of the job posting, go to our website at ckut.ca. CKUT is an equal opportunity employer, so if you wish to be considered for employment equity, please indicate so in your cover letter. To apply, send your cover letter and CV by email to hiring@ckut.ca. Deadline to apply is Friday, July 22nd at 5 p.m. Join the World Forum on Free Media for free public presentations and workshops. La prochaine édition du Forum mondial des médias libres aura lieu à l'Université McGill du 8 au 9 août. Le forum est né dans le cadre des forums sociaux mondiaux à travers la rencontre entre activistes en faveur de la liberté d'expression et de la lutte pour une autre forme de communication. Cette année, des personnes sont invitées d'une dizaine de pays. All events are accessible and translation is available. Panels will include Médias libres et environnement numérique et multiplateforme, Community Communications, Decolonizing Media and Technology, La sécurité pour qui? L'impact de la violence sociale et étatique sur la liberté d'expression. With participants from across North and South America, Africa, and Asia, the World Forum on Free Media events will take place at McGill University August 8th and 9th. Also, tune in to Off the Hour on CKUT the week of August 8th, broadcasting live from the forum. Pour obtenir plus d'infos et consulter le programme, veuillez consulter le site www.fmml.net. The World Forum on Free Media at McGill is supported by SHRC, DADF, and other groups. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Up next, we have audio from Rochester Indie Media that was recorded at an event in Rochester, New York, in April of this year. At the time, supporters of Jahlil Muntakim were preparing for his most recent parole bid that happened in June. At the event, Shannon Coleman, Michael Argaman, and Jake Spezio led a discussion on Jahlil's history and accomplishments.
We the movement, more than music. Winning all these battles, man, we no longer losing. We the people, organizing. Door to door knocking, waking up the uprising. See, we the movement, more than music. Winning all these battles, man, we no longer losing. See, I'm a rebel, man, it's so contagious. They don't even really want me in their job placements. It's outrageous, they are so racist, the system needs a facelift.
And 23 out of the 24 voted against the parole for him. And yes, there is some correlation between those two facts. It was only in the most recent parole hearing 2 years ago, in June of 2014, that there finally was an African-American parole board member that was on the panel that he spoke to, and that actually listened to him, and that said, yeah, it makes sense for you to be out. So the handout that we have up there, that Jahlil actually typed that up himself. He doesn't have a computer, but he has a typewriter, and so he typed it up and sent it to me. And that gives a lot of background, and it's written in a way so it's aimed at a more general audience, meaning it's not aimed at people that frequent the Flying Squirrel or Metro Justice or whatever, you know. So the point is that in order to be supportive of Jahlil, we need to expand beyond the small group of people that automatically would be supportive of him and try to find, you know, more supporters. So there are evangelical Christians, you know, that just believe that you know, in prison reform, there's libertarians that believe that, you know, there shouldn't, you know, it's government overreach to have so many people in prison. So people should try to reach out not just to our usual friends, but to try to expand the base of support for Jahlil, because on the other side, the patrolmen's so-called benevolent association, the police organization, they are able to send out, you know, from their database, you know, emails to tens of thousands of people every time there's a parole hearing coming up for Jahlil or anyone else who is involved in any way or suspected in any way of harming police. So they have a massive campaign, and Shannon's going to talk a little bit about the makeup of the parole board in general, and, you know, where these people come from. But, you know, it's already a situation that's not very favorable. Jahlil's next parole hearing, his ninth parole hearing, is on June 14th. And one of the things that we're hoping to do is that sometime earlier in June, in Rochester, Buffalo, Albany, and New York City, and maybe some other places, hopefully on the same day, if it works, is to have events in all of the cities across the state. Last year, we walked to the parole board offices, which is kind of near St. Joe's on South Avenue, near where Mount Hope and South Avenue come together in that area. So we may do that again. We're still trying to figure that out. That'll be a statewide thing. And hopefully everyone here afterwards, we'll try to make sure that we have everyone email addresses so that we'll be able to notify people. But let me stop there for a moment. Any questions about anything? Okay. So one of the things that we need to do to be helpful to Jaleel is sending letters to the head of the parole board, and that's something that at the end we can do. There's a lot more. The other thing that we're looking for is housing opportunities for Jaleel. So, like, I'm inviting him to live at my house, but if we can get a few different housing opportunities for him in writing that can go to him and to his attorneys, that would be helpful as they prepare the parole file that'll be submitted to the parole board. The other thing that we're looking for is employment opportunities for him. So just an example of one of the reasons that the two parole commissioners that voted against him last time, they cited some disciplinary issues. So here's the disciplinary issues that Jaleel has had in the last few years. He had two postage stamps, loose postage stamps, meaning not attached to an envelope, in his pocket on his way to or from the law library. I mean, that's the level of, you know, things that they're looking for him.
Did you hear about the book?
Yes, and his book. So his book, and there's a thing about his book of poetry that just came out. So his book, he ordered a copy of his book to come to him, and they confiscated it. They said he couldn't have his own book. Like, it's dangerous for him to read the things that he himself has written. They confiscated his book and a few other books.
They found it in a really ridiculous way, too. Like, he ordered a bunch of books, and the books went through the package room where they check all the stuff. Yeah. And then the CO that was, like, going to deliver it to his cell saw a picture of him on the back. And was like, what the fuck is this? You can't have this. And we'll make him the book that's wrong.
So, yeah. So,
I also have this, too, that I can pass around right now. It's like, you could sign this little petition.
But, so there's the issue of books. And then just an example of some of the stuff that Jaleel does. At the prison, in the visitor's room, the vending machines, the profits from the vending machines are supposed to be used for prisoners' welfare issues, like enhancing the TV stations that they get or something like that. But Jaleel found out that the money instead was going to fix up the office of the warden. So he initiated a lawsuit. You know, and when he does these types of things, number one, it doesn't endear him to the guards there. But the other thing is that sometimes there's a situation where when he gets to court, he gets to cross-examine the guards and other prison officials there. The state doesn't like that. So the state has tried to make a deal with him on certain things, and he keeps saying, I'll make a deal with you, give me parole. And, you know, if you use my disciplinary situation, and his disciplinary situation is actually really good. I mean, he really hasn't caused real, you know, physical trouble or violence there. I mean, you know, it's just like having a snap in your pocket or stuff like that. But because of this, they've tried to make deals with him, but he says, you know, if you're denying me parole because of, you know, stupid things like stamps, there's no deal other than, you know, granting parole. One of the other things that he's tried to do is to get, see if he could get on some sort of work release program also. But, I mean, he's a political person, so they're not really interested in that. So, you know, the truth is that it's an uphill battle. I mean, even if we have a place for him to live, a place for him to work, and all this other stuff, I mean, that's necessary, but it may not be sufficient. But we need to try. So.
Sure. I'm just going to talk about parole and kind of how it works a little bit. And like you said, Jaleel's up for his ninth time. And we have some interesting facts that I found today. Like as of 2013, there's 2 million people incarcerated in the United States. And then 1 in 50 are on probation or parole. So that means that 1 out of every 35 people in the United States is either on probation, on parole, and in jail. So it's just pretty ridiculous. There's currently 14 board members on the parole. that's all appointed by the governor. Some of them are still on there from Governor Pataki. Majority of them are, and one man has served like 30 something years, and he doesn't get out till 2019. Most of them are former like law enforcement, and they have little to no experience or anything. No sort of background.
The types of people that would be logical to be on the parole board might be social workers,
yeah.
Psychologists, psychiatrists, clergy people, community organizers, people that are involved in how people reintegrate into the community. That would be
right.
The logical type of person.
Yeah, something that they don't look at. There's been in 2012 there was legislation passed to actually look at the inmates like good time and what they've done while they're incarcerated and see who they are now. And then one of the main women publicly was like, no, we don't have to do that. And like, so they have like the executive was, one is relief is incompatible with the welfare of society. That's one thing that they look at. He or she would not live and remain at liberty without violating the law. And then release would deprecate the nature of the instant offense and to undermine respect for the law. So they're really, really focused on what did he do.
And the nature of the crime.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then in small fine print at the bottom of that law, it says that they can change. It is, the board may revise or modify the guidelines in whole or in part. So they can, they don't really have.
They do whatever they want.
They don't have rules. They're like working people that can just do whatever they want. And currently, I just read that they don't even have to see the person, they don't have to come in person. They can Skype them and be like, now they can Skype. That's what they do with Jaleel?
With Jaleel, yeah. Jaleel doesn't meet them. He stays in Attica, and they're in Rochester, at the office in Rochester or wherever.
Yeah, and so they just Skype them. They
still see each other on the board, too, because my dad actually served on a conditional release board for Livingston County, and he got kicked off the board because he was, like, too lenient.
Really?
So I'm wondering, the woman who actually was supportive of Jaleel, if she'll get reappointed.
Yeah, it's very possible that she
her name is Hal Rahan or something like that. She's from, I think, originally from Buffalo. So
they're all like,
you should pay attention to that.
And they focus on deny, because actually they're more worried about the governor who's appointed them and how they look in the public. Like, is the governor allowing all these convicts to run free or whatever?
Because it's not just the Benevolent Association that goes against people getting out. There's also like a few other organizations that it's like Victims of Violent Crime or something that also do letter writing. There is a lot of pressure from the opposing side.
Yeah, it's huge in the network.
Oh, and by the way, the son of one of the two police officers that was killed has come out in support of Jaleel's parole. But,
He does want to work out that. I think it would count for something in any other situation. And then another big problem with the parole is the indeterminate sentencing. So any crime before 1998 was like, whether violent or non, is like, so you get in trouble, you get 3 to 5 years. 3 years is up, then you're eligible for parole. But they can keep you in there even over your maximum, even after your 5 years. So Jaleel is eligible first in 2002, and he is now 19 years over his minimum.
Yeah, he got 25 to life, and he's been in 44. 40,
so 45.
19 years ago, he was theoretically eligible.
And this is his 9th parole, so he's
parole board.
And
have they had to at least give, according to those guidelines, their reasons for denying parole?
Those three reasons that I sense. They can just use those sentences. It's pretty much
is it Julia's weird nature of the crime over and over again.
Yeah, okay. It's a very generic sort of thing. They don't give it.
We can never forgive you.
But the nature of the crime will never change.
That's what everyone says.
But the other two don't even sound like it could apply if he's like peaceful and but they're just
All I need is one.
Isn't there some law that got passed that says they have to take into account like good behavior?
But they don't really. There's nothing to hold people.
Yeah, the woman said that she's not. They're not.
I mean, it's really because he got convicted of killing the cop. That's the only reason.
That's it. Yeah. And he's a troublemaker because.
Well, I don't know. Not in the last, 10, 15 years.
No, I mean, troublemaker meaning police.
Yeah, but even now, I mean, I was telling Jose, I do a program at Attica, and he will not even come to the program because he's worried about being seen as, instigating things.
Yeah. He's been super silent, just, chilling.
Have you met him?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Has anyone else here met Julio? Yeah.
No, please.
Okay, that's great. Okay.
I was going to ask you actually to talk a little bit about the Parole Safe Act.
So there's something called the Safe Parole Act, which, activists, prison reform and parole reform activists in the state are trying to get. It's a statewide thing. And I should have brought it. I don't remember the exact legislative number for things. But it's something we've been trying for a few years, and it's to try to change the definition of how they look at parole, meaning trying to focus less on the nature of the crime and more on the nature of the individual and their ability to integrate into society, et cetera, and to basically compel the parole board to change the focus. But, again, I don't know how likely that is. I mean, certainly with the Senate and, in the hands of the Republicans, it's not likely. And there's also a governor that's not that progressive. I mean, this is the governor who invited Hillary Clinton to his celebration of the $15 an hour minimum wage, which really isn't $15 an hour. And Hillary thought that $12 an hour was good. So it's just sort of really, this is the government who doesn't pardon anyone either.
Yeah, I have a question. Has Jaleel tried to transfer to a medium?
No. Jaleel, they don't allow him to choose, first of all, where he is.
Yeah, but the guys can submit to move down to a medium.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But I don't.
He got moved from. There was another one he was at in the 90s.
Well, the list has it's like he's been at every maximum in New York State.
Yeah, he's been at all maximums, and I think I don't think that. I mean, what he's trying to do is to. Well, I think that he asked for a work release, and I don't think there's work release from Attica, so I think that by asking for that would mean transferring to a lower level of security. But the other thing, just in general, that we're trying to do is find connections in Attorney General Snyderman's office to see if we can find somebody there who would be sympathetic. Mm-hmm. I tried Joe Morelli's office, not that I had high expectations, but I just thought, well, it makes sense to talk to people in the Assembly. Well, first I talked to Louise Slaughter. So Louise basically said, this isn't a federal issue, it's a state issue. And I said, so is a federal issue, but she still said that it really is a state issue. So then figuring state legislature, okay, Joe Morelli's office, he's my assemblyman. But the guy, his legislative assistant, whatever, kept coming back to things, but this is a cop killer, it's not going. There's very few politicians that will stick their neck out for someone like that unless they're lame duck. So, I mean, it would be nice if Obama, at the end of his term, since he's paroled a lot of low-level drug people, et cetera, so it would be nice if, he would parole, some political people also. Mm-hmm. I don't have a big expectation that will happen, but, it's a place where we need to apply pressure in a number of months, when we get closer to to that time. But I think that maybe there's people in the Attorney General's office. Now, the Attorney General himself, if he has higher political ambitions, he's not going to do anything that's going to piss off the police union. But,
That was audio from an event in Rochester, New York. It was coming to us from Rochester Indie Media. People at the event were talking about political prisoner and former Black Panther Jahlil Muntakim, who we've been talking about a lot on our show lately. That audio was recorded in April. Jahlil actually lost his bid for parole in June of this year, and he's currently asking his supporters to pressure New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo for clemency. The governor of New York State is actually able to essentially absolve Jahlil's sentence and let him out of prison now. So he's asking supporters to use the hashtag clemency for Jahlil, that's J-A-L-I-L, on social media, and say why you support him. And if you don't know that much about him, you can check out his website. There's a lot of information about him online. His website is freejahlil.com. He's asking folks to call, write, fax, email, or use social media to contact Governor Cuomo. And you can find Governor Cuomo's contact information online at governor.ny.gov. And you can, again, check out Jahlil's website to find out more information for how you can support him.
Tune in to Lit FM.
It'll really light up your day.
This Friday from 5 to 6,
you will hear awesome interviews, original
songs,
and interesting podcasts. Meow.
Tout est curieux sur ce sujet.
Comme l'Atlantis.
Les disabilités. Les livres.
La loutre de mer.
Cats.
Meow.
And an original song.
Now meet our hosts.
I'm Ocean.
I'm Mimi.
And we are May
and A.
Z.
Anu.
Abby.
So, j'espère que vous allez être à l'écoute.
Stay lit 90.3 FM. Oh yeah.
The time is presently 11:58, and you've been listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Thursday, August 11th at 5 p.m. And since August 11th is actually the day after Prisoner Justice Day, that will be our Prisoner Justice Day show. So we're asking or we're offering that if folks specifically or especially folks inside want to write to us, if there's anything you want us to read on the show, or if you have song requests or shout out stuff like that, we will be reading out the address where you can send us things. So again, our next show will be on Thursday, August 11th at 5 p.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 5-